Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Here's a question. Any news on what the new book will be? Asks, vague and pretentious. Vague and pretentious says new here, but the title says it all. Anna Karenina is almost finished, right? Any news on what the new book will be? This was actually answered by JMum8779, who said, we'll probably have a poll coming up. If I'm correct, we should be wrapping up Anna Karenina in March. Yeah, exactly right. We'll have a poll. We'll have some kind of a vote. And Anna Karenina will be finishing up, I think, March. Sounds about right. So in the weeks leading up to that, we'll start to vote. So that's the good news. The bad news is we don't know what we're reading next, but the good news is you get to have a say in what it is. What books are remaining? What's left on the list? We've got, let's have a quick look, Madame Bovary, which I'm looking forward to. The Red and the Black, which intrigues me. Of Human Bondage also intrigues me. Button Brooks, don't know anything about it. Hail and Farewell, don't know much about that. Oxford Book of English Verse, it scares me. I'm kind of not looking forward to that. And The American. That's what we got left. There's some good titles coming up. It does. I don't know. Makes me nervous to think that we'll be moving away from Anna Karenina. It's like I've been institutionalized by this book and I'm scared to leave it. Stockholm Syndrome. thanks for asking that, vague and pretentious. And we hope you'll join in the daily conversations and the podcasts and everything when the new book is announced. Now, part 6, chapter 24. Is Anna popping opiates? Anna and Dolly don't seem to see eye to eye anymore. Swim said the mama fishy said, I believe she has become addicted to morphine. It explains why I find her behavior so different than earlier in the book. Recall the doctors gave her morphine after the birth of her daughter, and morphine was readily available over the counter in the 19th century. Jeez, can you imagine? You just have it. Just, I've got a toothache. Morphine. I found a scholarly article that discusses Anna and her use of morphine. I'm not sharing it because spoilers galore, but her new habit of screwing up her eyes may be because opiates cause the eyes to stay dilated. She may have developed the new squinting habit to limit the amount of light in her eyes. I can understand the allure of morphine. After a major surgery, I was given morphine shots for pain. I could only have one shot every 40 minutes. After each shot, I felt like a warm water bath sweeping through my body, taking all the pain away and leaving me with a pleasant feeling. I was very vigilant in paging the nurse every 40 minutes for my morphine dose. Family lore has it that one of my great-grandfathers became a morphine addict after losing a leg in an accident. Easy to do, I think. I mean, I've never had morphine, but yeah, I think opiates in general, easy to become addicted to. I have always known that if any drug was ever going to get me, it would be opiates, you know, Oxycontin or, you know, heroin or something like that. That would be what would get me. Because just the way it's described by so many people, it just sounds like exactly what I've always wanted, pretty much. So it's a scary thing. Another funny trend I've noticed over the years since being a young man was that people that I idolized, even throughout history, or famous artists over the years, or just people that I really just, you know, you have that, you idolize them because they're so skilled at whatever they do, at whatever their art form is. But at the same time, you also just relate to them. And I had this trend happen where, you know, you become infatuated with different idols over your developing years. And everyone I would become infatuated with and later find out that they were a heroin addict. There was literally like a string of, I'm going to say, a dozen people who I really, really loved, whether they're comedians, musicians, actors, writers, you name it. They all had that in common. And so I just knew there's something about that, their personality type really resonates with me. And I think that's a common, that's what ties it all together. Oh, morphine. I've never had morphine. I've never had heroin either, by the way. It's just that kind of feeling like, I'm going to steer clear of that one for sure. Not that I don't do any drugs, but that one in particular. There's a Russell Brand quote about it. Sorry, getting a bit off topic, but he describes the feeling, and a lot of people have described it in similar ways, but this one always stuck with me. He said, like, you know how babies or like little toddlers, they want something and they'll get all fussy and the mum will try to find out, like, what do you want? Like, I can't figure out what you want. And the kid themselves don't know what they want. They just know they want something, but they don't know what it is. And it's like, and then you grow up and that feeling sticks with you. Like you want something, but you don't know what it is. And you're like, am I thirsty? Am I this? Am I that? And you're always trying to like band-aid up. What's this thing that I'm always like, I always feel like I want something. And like, I might have a soft drink and it might go away very temporarily, but it's still always just there. You've just kind of quietened it. Anyway, he goes on about that and he goes, but then the first time you try heroin, it's like, this is the thing that I've been yearning for since I was a toddler and not being able to articulate what it is. He's like, this is the thing. And he said, it doesn't make you feel like high. It doesn't make you feel out. What's it called, like inebriated or anything like that. You still just feel yourself. You just feel like whatever that thing that was missing, you've now got it. Anyway, I just remember him describing that and just thinking, oh, whoa, like that's so relatable. Probably relatable for everyone, but yeah, I just thought, yeah, I can never have that. I can never have that. Anyway, sorry, way off topic. So Anna, whoa, what a twist. Anna's a morphine addict. Simply Productive says, I definitely think Anna is addicted to morphine, and I think that this bodes very, very ill for what will happen next. Addiction is an awful, life-destroying thing. It looks like Dolly is becoming a nice change of pace for me, at least. She seems a bit judgmental, but then again, what are sisters for? And it's nice to see her get a bit of a personality. All I really thought of her was as the sort of hysterical woman who has been cheated on, and that was really the only context I felt Dolly gave us. It's good to see her spring into life. This is what I'm learning Tolstoy is good at. I'm going to propose a character foil in terms of depression, Anna versus Dolly. It certainly looks to me like they are both a bit depressed. However, my hypothesis is that Dolly will end up all right and Anna won't. I think Anna will get worse. It will be interesting if I'm right, because they're both women affected by adultery, but one couple stayed together and one didn't. I think if I'm right, maybe Tolstoy is grandstanding a bit about his views on adultery. A pretty big guess with a quarter yet to be read, but we'll see if I'm right. I think it's a bit less than a quarter. I think it's more like, I'm going to say like 20%. Wait, that's not much. It's about the same thing, isn't it? Well, if Anna is a morphine addict, then this book becomes about a morphine addict. Like, that's the biggest thing that's happened in this book so far, is it not? I mean, no, that's a very objective thing. Subjective? Debatable thing. Whatever I'm trying to say. But, like, that's like the biggest twist in this book. Jay Mama said, there were hints of the addiction in mild spoilers. How bad her habit is remains to be seen. However, she mentioned it once, then one page later, retires to her room to indulge in a dose. I get the feeling this is a big problem. Yep. Oh, excuse me. Yeah, no, I have the same feeling. you don't just sort of dabble with morphine. It also puts a very different spin on the whole Italy trip and like everything that's been happening with her so far. I suppose maybe that's where the intrigue of this book is rereading it and looking how far back through the book can you see hints of a morphine addiction. Starfall 15 says, looks like you were exactly right to blame Lydia that the divorce has not happened yet, or at least she is part of it. Anna hasn't written the letter yet either, but because of Lydia, Anna doesn't think Karenin would still grant the divorce. I didn't understand Anna's listing her son as a reason not to seek the divorce. She never sees him anyway. Does she harbour some hope that the situation might change? Perhaps she simply despairs of ever finding true happiness again, so she's not motivated to make any effort to change things. The conversation was pretty depressing, so I don't blame Dolly for wanting to get out of there. I am Norwegian quoted, whenever I think about it, I cannot go to sleep without morphine. Uh-oh. Indeed. I tried to write a response yesterday on my phone, but I managed to delete it accidentally. In it, I compared Anna to one of those Inuit-filled housewives from the 50s, dependent on mother's little helpers sitting vapidly around the house, hiding behind a facade. Of course, the mother's little helpers thing didn't fit, but I still got that feeling. I think he did make that comment. I feel like I remember reading that. I didn't read yesterday's comments, but after listening to the podcast, I have to disagree with the accusations of Tolstoy essentially excusing himself from self-involved self-examination. In a confession, he is brutal on himself and the life that he had led. He doesn't try to justify anything. He doesn't try to argue that he's innocent or that society or other people is to blame. He calls most of his activity in the intellectual sphere circle-jerking, essentially. He calls himself a thief, a murderer. He is thorough and harsh. The comment might have been accurate if you look at Tolstoy in his youth, but in the context of Anna Karenina, I don't think it's fair. Well, you know what? I need to look something up. That's on my mind. We search. We were talking about loftiness of soul, weren't we? All right, we were. And someone came up with a definition of it, and it was brilliant. Ah, here it is. Okay. A quick Google search found a theory that posits the loftiness of soul, which is certainly a phrase I've heard before. Sublime. And the opposite, the antonym, puerility. Anyway, sorry. That just popped into my head for some reason. I think it's because I really liked that word. It's a complete curveball for you. It had nothing to do with this conversation we're actually having. But I'm glad I found that. Loftiness of soul. It popped into my head because today I remembered it. Loftiness of soul. But I couldn't remember the antonym, the other word. And I was like, trying to find the definition of loftiness of soul so that I could find the antonym, but could not find it anywhere on Google. And so it just popped into my head now, and I thought, well, I'm going to look it up before I forget. All right. I'm very tired. That's why I'm rambling. I apologize, and I thank you for being so patient. Chapter 25 of this book goes a little bit like this. Vronsky and Anna went on living in the country in the same way, still taking no steps to obtain a divorce all the summer and part of the autumn. They had agreed not to go anywhere, but the longer they lived alone, the more they both felt, especially in autumn, when there were no visitors, that they would not be able to hold out and that a change was inevitable. Their life seemed one that could not be improved upon. They had ample means, good health, a child, and both had occupations of their own. In the absence of visitors, Anna still continued to devote attention to her person and read a great deal, both novels and such serious books as were in fashion. She ordered all the books that were praised in the foreign newspapers and magazines they received, and read them with the attention one gives only to what one reads in solitude. She studied, also from books and from technical papers, all the subjects with which Vronsky was occupied, so that he often came straight to her with questions about agriculture, architecture, and sometimes even horse breeding or sport. He was astounded at her knowledge and memory, and at first used to doubt her information and want it confirmed. She would then find what he wanted in books and show it to him. The arrangement of the hospital also interested her. There she not only helped, but arranged and planned many things herself. Nevertheless, her chief preoccupation was still herself insofar as Vronsky held her dear, and insofar as she could compensate him for all he had given up. Vronsky appreciated this, which had become the sole aim of her life, a desire not only to please him but also to serve him, but at the same time he was troubled by these love meshes in which she tried to entangle him. As time went on, the oftener he felt himself caught in these meshes, the more he desired not exactly to escape from them, but to try whether they really interfered with his freedom. Had it not been for this ever-increasing desire for freedom, not to have a scene each time he had to go to town, to a meeting, or to the races, Vronsky would have been quite content with his life. The role he had chosen, that of a rich landowner, one of those who should constitute the kernel of the Russian aristocracy, was not only quite to his taste, but, now that he had lived so for half a year, gave him ever-increasing pleasure. His affairs, which occupied and absorbed him more and more, progressed excellently. In spite of the tremendous sums, the hospital, the machinery, the cows which he imported from Switzerland, and many other things were costing him, he was sure that he was not wasting his substance, but increasing it. Where it was a question of income, the sale of forest land, of corn or wool, or the leasing of land, Vronsky was as hard as flint and could hold out for his price. In all operations on a large scale, both on this and on his other estates, he kept to the simplest and safest methods and was extremely economical and careful in his expenditure on small details, despite all the cunning and artfulness of the German steward, who tried to lead him into expenditure and presented all estimates in such a way that it at first appeared as if much would be required, though on consideration the things could be done more cheaply and an immediate profit obtained, Vronsky did not submit to him. He listened to what the stewards had to say and questioned him, but only consented when the things to be ordered or built were the latest, as yet unknown in Russia, and likely to astonish people. Besides, he decided on a big outlay only when he had money to spare, and when spending he went into every detail and insisted on getting the very best for his money. So that from the way he managed his business it was clear that he was not wasting but increasing his property. In October there were the nobility elections in the Kashin province, in which Vronsky's, Sviatsky's, Koznishev's, and also a small part of Levin's estates were situated. Various circumstances, as well as the men who took part in them, caused these elections to attract public attention. They were much discussed, and preparations were made for them. People living in Moscow and Petersburg, as well as others from abroad who had never come to any elections, assembled at these. Vronsky had long ago promised Sviatsky to be present. Before the election, Sviatsky, who often visited at Vozdzhensk, called for Vronsky. Vozdvizhensk. The day before, Vronsky and Anna had almost quarrelled about this proposed journey. It was autumn, the dullest and most depressing time of year in the country, and so Vronsky, bracing himself for a struggle, announced his departure in a sterner and colder way than he had ever before used to Anna. But to his surprise, Anna took the news quite quietly and only asked when he would return. He looked at her attentively, not understanding this calm manner. She answered his look with a smile. He knew her capacity for withdrawing into herself and knew that she only did it when she had come to some resolution in her own mind without telling him of her plans. He feared this, but he so wished to avoid a scene that he pretended to believe, and to some extent sincerely believed, in what he wished to believe, namely, in her reasonableness. I hope you won't be dull. I hope not, replied Anna. I received a box of books from Gortier's yesterday. a well-known Moscow bookseller. No, I shan't be dull. She means to adopt this tone, well, so much the better, thought he, or else it would be the usual thing again. And so, without challenging her to a frank explanation, he left for the elections. It was the first time since their union that he had parted from her without a full explanation. On the one hand, this fact disturbed him, but on the other hand, it seemed the best way. At first, there will be, as now, something uncertain, something concealed, but afterwards she will get used to it. In any case, I can give her everything else, but not my independence as a man, he reflected. Alrighty, there we go. Another chapter chaptered. Successfully. Successful chaptering of the chapter. Pat yourself on the back. And also, thanks very much for being with me here tonight on the podcast. Appreciate it. As always, I'll see you tomorrow.